Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Now, our first guest has written a memoir told through a series of intimate portraits, which build into a poignant and insightful testimony of West Indian British experience. To tell us about I'm Black So You Don't Have to Be, a memoir in eight lives, welcome to the show, Colin Grant.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Now, I believe the title came from your uncle, is that right?
Yes, I have an uncle who in the book is called Castus. And Uncle Cassus came to Britain in the early 60s when I was born. He came as a young boy at 14. But as we grew up, we were more like brothers than uncle and nephew. And in his estimation, he's better looking than me. He's more charming. He's more erudite. He's sexier. But he hasn't had the breaks in life that I've had. And time again, he would say to me, Colin, I'm black, so you don't have to be. And I think what he means by that is that he arrived too soon in the culture to be considered just an individual. He was just thought of as just another irksome darkie. And he was doing all the heavy lifting in order to make my life easier.
And was it? Was your life easier?
Well, it's probably easier than his life. I wouldn't want my life to be a smooth passage in any case. There'd be nothing to write about if it was all lying on the beach and enjoying yourself. But I think each generation perhaps has it slightly easier than the previous generation. And I think that is generally true of life, no matter whether you're a West Indian or any other migrant, really.
So you say this was the 60s. That wasn't the Windrush generation then, was it?
Well, yeah, it's a funny phrase, isn't it, the Windrush generation, because it's become a phrase which we now think we understand. The Windrush arrived in 1948, but the real mass migration from the Caribbean to Britain came between 1948 and 1962. And in 1962, the British government changed the legislation to make the arrival of Caribbean people to live and work here more difficult. So I think of the Windrush generation as that generation who arrived between the late 1940s and mid-1960s. So right. Yes, he would be part of the Windrush generation.
I understand. And as we said, this is a memoir in eight lives, one of them being your mum, Ethlyn, I believe.
Yeah, my mum, Ethlyn Veronica Adams, is her maiden name. She came here in the 1950s. 1959, she arrived here. And she was one of those people who always yearns to go back. You know, there's a great tradition, I think, of migrants when they arrive in any country. They have a five-year plan to work some money, as we say in Jamaica, and then to return. But after a while, the 5 years becomes 10, the 10 becomes 15. And before you know, you wake up, as we did one day, to see our parents changing the wallpaper. And when your parents change the wallpaper, you know that you're here to stay. But Ethlyn is the kind of the rock and at the center of the story. She's a great storyteller herself. And without her, there'd be no stories for me to tell, really. She's a woman who made only one mistake in her life, and that was marrying my father, Bad Guy.
That's your dad's name.
Yeah, he's called Bad Guy. A lot of the Caribbean people that I grew up with of my parents' generation, they all had these funny nicknames. So my father's actually called Clinton George Grant, but his nickname was Bad Guy because he had permanent bags on his eyes from the age of about 16. And all the people that I grew up with, all the West Indians that I grew up with in the 60s and 70s in Luton, where I'm from, had this amazing, strange nickname. So Bad Guy had these baggy eyes. Shine was bald. Pumpkinhead had a pumpkin-shaped head. Tidy Boots, very fussy about his footwear. Anxious, was always very anxious. Clock had one arm longer than the other. And my all-time favorite was a man they call Summerware. And when Summerware came to this country in 1959 from Jamaica, he insisted on wearing light summer suits, tropical suits, no matter the weather, come rain or storm. And in the course of writing and researching the book, I could remember his name, but I couldn't picture him. So I asked my mum, Ethan, whatever became of Summerware? And she said, well, within a few months of coming to Britain, he caught a chill and died. And I think my mum told it as a kind of straight story. She wasn't telling it for humorous purposes. But if you were called Summerware, you see, Celine, there's no way that you can wear a heavy coat. You have to live to your name. And that's what I like about these people. They had their own kind of individual style, and they clung to their individuality, sometimes through their name.
What a great story. And Bagai, your dad, apparently he was a small-time ganja dealer.
Yeah, so you might be surprised or not by the sound of my voice. So I often say that my education was funded by marijuana. So I'm from a working-class Caribbean family in Luton. And when I was growing up, at the age of about 10, my parents both recognized that I had good brains. They were feeding me all the fish that they could get their hands on, but it wasn't going to work. I was destined for the failing state school. And so my mum convinced my father they must scrimp and save and send me to a private school. But he was working at Vauxhall Motors on the production line. There's only one wage coming in. And I think he thought that he would supplement his income by selling marijuana, mostly to his Caribbean friends who came to Britain with their love of ganja and marijuana intact. So I think he didn't think of himself as carrying out some sort of criminal activity. I think he thought of himself as carrying out some sort of social service. So I was his bag man. He'd make these little sachets of marijuana, put them in my briefcase, and we'd drive around Luton, dropping them off to his Caribbean friends. And through that, I was able to go to this private school in St. Albans, a place called St. Columbus College. But I should say, Selena, that, and to your listeners, that crime doesn't pay, mostly. Going to get caught. So eventually the police come to our house, the radar house, about 12 of them in a big white van, and they rifle through the house to pull up in all the drawers. They smash everything to find the marijuana. They find a huge stash of marijuana. And miraculously, my father is arrested, but doesn't go to jail. He has a trial. He's put on trial, but he charms the judge into giving him just a heavy sentence. And that year, 1972, about 700 people in this country, in Britain, went to jail for possession of marijuana, and he got off with a heavy fine for dealing marijuana. Wow. But after that transgression, I should add, actually, Selena, that my mother's father was a policeman, so she felt the disgrace very heavily, and she showed Bad Guy the door after that. And what was really interesting to me is that I managed to stay on at this very expensive private school. I should say it was a Catholic school run by American monks, Brothers of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And every term I'd get a letter from the bursar, and I'd open the letter before giving it to my mum. And the letter said more or less, you're late with the fees again, Mrs. Grant. And remember, this is a Catholic school. My mother would write back immediately to the bursar saying, well, what would Jesus do? So she shamed them into giving me a free education. Praise the Lord.
Clever, clever lady.
Yes, very, very clever.
Very clever. It would be unfair to pull you out, you know, when you're sort of halfway through your education.
Yeah, I think also, in all honesty, I benefited from the fact that by then, actually, my brother was there as well. So the two of us, we were the only black kids in this school in St. Albans. And as I said, they were run by American monks, Brothers of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And I think these American monks were still reeling from the civil rights movement in America, and in a way were ashamed about what had happened to African-American people in America at the hands of the white people, the authorities. And we kind of benefited from that, from their shame. I think they got good response for their souls by treating me especially kindly and allowing me this free education.
Yes, thank the Lord, as you say. And somebody else who features as one of your eight lives is your sister Selma. Tell us about Selma.
So Selma, again, I think Bagai must have been a small-time gadget dealer for more than just me, because Selma, also my big sister who's 4 years older than me, she also went to a private school, St. Francis College, which is more expensive than St. Columbus College, actually. And she was one of those people who can code switch, which is a phrase which refers to you to be able to sort of live in more than one culture. So she could speak the Queen's English, but she could also speak heavy patois. And she was one of those bright children who embarrassed their father because they show their father to be a smallish person, to be a slightly ignorant person. And she would, I think, humiliate my father just through her intelligence. And on one of these occasions, she must have said something bad to him. And at that time, she was about 14, and she was growing her nails, Selena, to get ready to go to a party. And she was painting her nails, and Bagai came down into the living room where she was and started to scream at her, "Why? Where are you going with those claws?" "Them claw," is what he would say. And what is really what he was upset about was, I think, of her kind of her individuality. And he took his hand in her hand and he got a pair of scissors and he cut all of her nails off.
Aww.
But that was, I mean, sometimes people say to me, "Where's all the violence and where's the misery?" And I say to him, "Well, I don't need to paint with a big, broad brushstroke. I can just suggest things." And there you have, I don't have any other violence in that book other than the cutting of the nails, because there you have it. There you have an idea of the man who has dominion over his children, and you have a sense of him being this tyrant. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't do any more violence than that. Because also, it must be said that even though there's lots of misery and trauma in our lives, there was a lot of joy and happiness as well. And sometimes I think people lose sight of the fact that you can have both.
That's true.
My approach is, even with if there are tough things, I like to try to write about them in a way that I find amusing, and I hope that the reader does too.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And does your uncle feature in one of the eight lives?
Yes, so my uncle, who's a rambunctious Jamaican, he features in the chapter about my time at the BBC. So I was a producer, a radio producer on BBC Radio 4 and the World Service for about 20 years. And I should point out at this point that even though I was an altar boy for 7 years, I was a head boy at junior school, I was a head boy at senior school, I went to medical school for 5 years, I hold the record in the whole history of the BBC for the highest number of disciplinary hearings.
Oh.
And yes. But I think it came down to cultural differences and cultural misunderstandings, shall we say. I think what happened with me is that I think the BBC managers, not everybody in the BBC, but the BBC managers came to see me as a kind of Trojan horse. So you know the story of the Trojan War, and the Greeks were outside of the Trojan Wall for many years. They can't get in. And eventually they seem to give up and they offer this Trojan horse. So the Trojan horse comes inside the compound of Troy, and then the Greek soldiers get out and they burn down Troy. I think the managers of the BBC thought they'd let a Trojan horse, i.e. me, into the building because I seemed to be just like them up until the first 15 years. But then after 15 years, I exhibited individuality, which you're not allowed to do in the BBC. You're not allowed to have opinions, especially if you're just a member of staff. And so, yeah, I got into trouble for questioning the authority of the people who were supposed to have authority. And my uncle, Castus, would appear in the in that chapter, and I'd say to him, he'd be my counsel after every disciplinary hearing was announced. And then a disciplinary hearing, by the way, I don't advise anybody to ever have one, but they go on for months and months and months. I remember after the first one, I rang up my uncle. I said, what does this mean? And he said, I won't swear, but he said, "It means, Colin, you are effed, shall we say."
I think we can work that one out.
Effed. But he was wrong in a way, because I managed to survive them all. And I survived them all because ultimately, on some of them, they had to find out whether the charge that they have leveled against you is true or not. And so one of them, I was accused of being aggressive. And I think what they meant was I was tall and black and I leaned over somebody. And they interviewed everybody I'd ever worked with at the BBC. We went on for about 6 months. And afterwards, the man who was conducting the hearing, which is like a trial, really, he summoned me to hear the verdict. And with a heavy heart, he said, "The case against you is not proven, Colin," which means they think I'm a wrong one, but they can't prove it. So, my uncle would have counseled me to have left the BBC at that first instance, but I was a bit stubborn and I didn't think that I should be the person leaving the BBC. I thought my accusers should be leaving because they were the wrong people to be there in the first place.
Well, your own life sounds really interesting. So are you featured in the book?
Yeah, so the story is that I have written this memoir, which is kind of about me, but it's told from the point of view of these other people. And the reason for doing that, Selina, is that sometimes I teach creative writing in Britain at Oxford University and some other places. And I always say to the students that the temptation when you write a memoir is to paint yourself as the hero. But it's difficult to hold on to that idea if you allow people to come and show that you are a man or a woman who has foibles. And so I'm there, but there are also characters in the book who don't like me, who give a different perspective on my character to the reader. And sometimes the reader will see that I'm not this sort of saint that I might have painted myself, but I'm a bit of a cheeky, mischievous rascal as well.
And you mentioned about your writing. This is actually your seventh book, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I've written mostly about African Caribbean life. My first book was about this man called Marcus Garvey, who was a big figure. He was kind of like the Black Churchill of his time in the 1920s in North America, in Harlem, in New York. So I wrote a big book about him. I've wrote about the Wailers. I'm really looking forward to, I hope you are too, but a new movie coming out about Bob Marley called Bob Marley, One Love.
Oh, right. No, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, it's a Paramount movie. It's coming out in February. It's going to be a big, big, big movie. So I'm actually reviewing that for the New York Review of Books. So I've written about Bob Marley, Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer. I've written about the Windrush generation. So I wrote a big book, which is a kind of oral history of Caribbean migration to Britain. I've written about epilepsy. My father had epilepsy. I wrote a cultural history of epilepsy. And my next book, which is the one I'm really looking forward to, is going to be another oral history, but an oral history of migration to Britain generally. So, for instance, why are there so many Yemenis in South Shields? Why are there 1,000 Serbs in Bourneville? Why are there 4,000 South Koreans in New Malden? And the book is called Proper People, and it's going to give you a different perspective, paint a different tapestry of what the life is, what the cohort of people who live in this country really are. And to complicate that story once and for all, that we're not a homogenous culture. In fact, we hardly ever have been.
Well, we're selling this book right now on our website. It's called I'm Black, So You Don't Have to Be, A Memoir in 8 Lives. It's by Colin Grant, who we're chatting to now. And do you have your own website as well, Colin?
Yes, it's my name, colingrant.info. ColinGrant.info. You can find me there and you can see all of the other writing I do, because I write a lot for the newspapers, The Guardian and The Observer especially.
Great stuff. Well, it's been a delight to chat to you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Bye-bye for now.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of U.S. Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made to last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.